a gun in the face.
Then all of a sudden, they all kind of lined up. They pointed their guns at me. And this is the point where I thought, I'm going to die today.
Started 2 years of horror for an American in Venezuela.
They said, you need to give us your phone and get ready because you're coming with us.
I'm Becky Bruce, and I spent a year researching and piecing together Josh and Tammy Holt's story about their ordeal in a notorious prison.
That's when everything started to turn bad. We had another pound on the door. Boom, boom, boom. And there was the police once again.
You can binge all of the episodes of Hope and Darkness on KSLPodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
In today's episode of Project Recovery,
parents just don't realize how dangerous opioids can be.
Family members should now have at least some information to know where they can go to start talking about it, but shame still happens.
Make sure you listen to the end. Find us on Facebook at Project Recovery. We'll have that and much more coming up. Hey, welcome to Project Recovery, a podcast about addiction, but more importantly, it's about recovery, and it's brought to our friends at useonlyasdirected.org. They got a three-part solution to the opioid epidemic, that is speak out, opt out, and of course, throw out. And as always, Dr. Matt, how are you?
I'm doing good. How are you?
Well, you know what? I've kind of got some weird things going because as we talked about last week, I'm done officially blowing.
Yes.
And that means that I'm no longer required to go twice a day down.
Got your certificate.
Yeah, a certificate. I hung it on the wall.
Yeah.
Everything's good to go. But I've got a lot of people in the recovery world coming up to me and going, now what?
Mm-hmm.
And I think when you're in the recovery world, a lot of people are always looking for that now what. And I've kind of done some soul searching and figured it out is that I think this is forever changing and forever evolving. I don't think you ever get to a place where you're complacent and go, I've got this. So I'm just constantly moving forward and trying to figure out where I'm going to take this. Because for the first time in 30 years, I've got a clear mind, a clear head. And I'm looking at things different. Does that sound weird to say at 46?
I think it sounds awesome. No, I mean, I think that's the goal. At every stage of life, if you can kind of grow with your stage of life and be your best self, then a lot of options open up for you. So, no, I think that's awesome.
I think a lot of times in the addiction and the recovery world, people look at being sober as the end goal.
Right.
And what I, you know, and I talked about this on a couple episodes ago that is that I'm getting a lot of accolades for finishing the things that I was required to do by law and to stay sober.
Well, to kind of get your basics of life back, right? The basics.
But I felt like sometimes that those accolades were undeserved because I'm just doing what I should have been doing all along. You know,
yeah, and you could look at it that way, you know, but it's still hard because a lot of people want to tell you they're proud of you because they themselves maybe have had a hard time doing those things.
And I know that this podcast has changed people's lives and given them hope and inspiration when they needed it and they were in dark times. But that's what I'm saying is that getting sober wasn't my end goal. Getting my life back and actually being present and living in the moment is what life's all about. And if you're always present and living in the moment, that's what you do.
Yeah. So what's next?
I don't know, but I'm excited for it.
Cirque du Soleil. I think you got to try out for that.
You know, I think I'm getting a little old. Like today at the gym.
Yeah, you're working out. You're bendy. You could do some of that stuff.
But I was on the treadmill.
Yeah.
And I was listening to Barbara Mandrell.
Oh, okay.
So I think the days of me being young are way past.
Did you pull a hammy listening to Barbara Mandrell?
Wouldn't that be great?
That'd be awesome. Hey, we're going to make you a playlist.
But you're more of a kind of a free spirit, Pixies kind of alternative.
Pixies, alternative, hardcore, yeah, all that stuff. Yeah, we'll get you going. We'll get you pumped up. Not that there's anything wrong with Barbara Mandrell.
Hey, she was beautiful.
Yeah, probably still is. I don't know.
At one point in the song, George Jones came out.
I don't know George Jones.
Oh, he's a living legend. He was country royalty, man.
Okay, that might be why I don't know him.
We're all learning stuff, and I wanted everybody to learn something, so that's why we invited David Watkins here. He's the Regional Prevention Director from Weber Human Services. David, how are you, my man?
I'm doing good. Thanks for having me.
Hey, so talk to us about what's going on right now in the state with the opioid epidemic.
Yeah. So one of the things we're finding right now is that oftentimes parents, people in the public just don't realize how dangerous opioids can be, particularly when they get a prescription from their doctor. It seems safe. It was prescribed by my doctor, so I can just take these, no risk, no risk of addiction. But there really is that risk associated with there with
now,
them.
I knew you were coming in today, and so a lot of times as I'm driving down, I'm thinking of things in my head of how I'm going to relate to this. And this popped in, and if it doesn't work, let me know. But I think the same instructions that are given to you when you're given a gun should be the same for opioids, because in the wrong hands, these things are deadly. And if you don't know what you're getting into, this is not a good situation. And a lot of people just get them and take them and don't understand the ramifications and all the things that could happen and be associated with these drugs.
Absolutely. Having a conversation with your doctor when you're prescribed them, I think is key. Oftentimes doctors are busy and in a rush, and they just want to write you the prescription and get you out the door, right? Because they want need to see their next patient. But if you can take the time, ask them a few key questions, you're going to be a much better owner of that opioid prescription. You're going to know how to take them. You're going to know when to stop taking them. And then you might know what to do with them when you're done taking them.
Now, yeah. Dr. Matt had his son's wisdom teeth pulled out. It was a little over a year ago, right?
Right.
And you'd been doing this podcast, and you were savvy enough to have a conversation with the doctor and your son to see what things could be had. Tell me about that.
Even though I work in healthcare, to be honest, sometimes you do just kind of go with the flow, whatever is prescribed. And having gotten into this podcast and being more and more educated on the opioid epidemic, that made me slow down. And to the doc's credit, he was in a hurry, like you said. But as soon as I asked a question about, well, are there alternatives? Can we talk a little bit more about this with my son? And he slowed right down, and we ended up with a different prescription, just four pills, a much more mild prescription. And then he taught us about using ibuprofen and acetaminophen instead of opiates over time, which I think is an excellent way to manage postoperative pain when possible. So, yeah, I appreciated the fact that just I've benefited from this idea of, being more educated and raising our awareness about the issue. And actually what was cool was my son, when I talked to him about it later when he got less goofy from his post-op. He was like, yeah, Dad, thanks. That makes sense, because he didn't want to run that risk of an addiction. So that's one of the things that I think is great about what you guys do and other folks is helping the public become more educated on this issue. But you mentioned at the beginning, people are still not recognizing the dangers. Is that right?
Yeah, I'd like to point out, I think a lot of positives have been changed in the medical side of things. The policies and things out there now, prescriptions are usually a lot smaller than they used to be. I remember years ago, it was always a story. I had my wisdom teeth pulled, and I had a pill bottle of 30 pills, and I only took two of them type of a thing. That's changed a lot. And then on the flip side of that, patients are becoming more aware. But yeah, overall, a lot of the research shows that there's still some of this not enough knowledge amongst the public about how risky these medications can be for themselves or for their family members.
If you or like what advice would you have for somebody who either they themselves or their child is about to be prescribed something like this, an opiate for pain? What question, like if there is one go-to question to help them get some information, what would you recommend they ask?
Yeah, and I think this leads right into the perfect name of the new campaign. The News Only is directed to switching their name around, kind of changing the focus of the campaign. It's going to be Know Your Script moving forward. Know your script. Know what to say to your doctor. Know your script when you talk to your children. Know your script when you talk to your elderly parents that might also be getting opioids. The question I think is important. I like the alternative question. So are there alternatives to this? And then two, what's my risk for addiction? And then maybe three, what's the plan for getting me off of these? So that going into it, right there, as soon as you leave that doctor's office, exactly how long you should be taking them. And then if there's any plan for helping you get off of them at the end of that cycle.
Now, we know the opioid, it's an epidemic right now and everything's going crazy. Are you kind of taken back that people still don't believe prescription medication can be dangerous as it is?
Yeah, I mean, I work in the field, so like it does kind of surprise me that there isn't more knowledge out there about the risks associated with it. But at the same time, I go into the doctor's office, and if that doctor, he's the authority figure in the room, right? And so if I have an ailment, I rolled my ankle playing basketball, and he prescribes me an opioid to deal with the pain for a few weeks, I'm probably going to take it. And so being knowledgeable about the questions to ask, I think, is really, really important, because they do want to have a conversation with us, but they are in a hurry, so they often just rush through it. And then, two, just us being educated on the risks. Looking up, doing some research on whatever that prescription or medication was given to us is really important, so that we ourselves understand the risk to ourselves.
Now, David, why do you think the general public, like myself or a parent out there, doesn't ask questions? What do you think the major roadblock is? Is it because we don't want to look stupid? We're in a rush for time? I mean, why do you think we're not asking these questions?
Yeah, I think it's a rush for time. We're always get in, get out, right? Like, that's what we do in society these days. And I think the other one is just maybe a lack of knowledge of what to ask. Again, we're talking to an authority figure who's prescribing us something. We don't want to ask them something because we think that they just know what they're doing. And so if we don't know what question to ask, we're probably not going to ask a question because we just don't know that there should be something asked.
I think one thing that's crossed my mind before is changing what we call things, because the words we put on things create sort of reactions and connotations. And so I found in talking with some of my patients who've struggled with this, the idea of it being called a painkiller is a little too general, right? So aspirin is a painkiller, or Excedrin is a painkiller, but an opiate's a painkiller too. And we're not going to get addicted to aspirin, but we can get addicted to opiates. So one of the things that has crossed my mind in talking with the people that come in and work with me is, let's change what we call it so that it gives it a heavier weight. So if you're calling something an opiate, now we know what that is, as opposed to just the general term painkiller. I may need some aspirin if I have a headache, and we don't want to lump those all together. What do you think about that?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think as I've worked on some of these campaigns across the state, I think another issue is sometimes we throw out the word opioid, and there's a whole list of opioids out there. And so I might not know that the prescription I got was an opioid. And so just even education on the term opioid, what that is related to, and what all the other sub medications are associated with that. But I agree that the language around that, and it should be known too, like, just because I got an opioid prescription doesn't mean I'm going to become addicted. Most people don't. And they are very valid reasons to take an opioid. And so again, knowing the right questions to ask that doctor or that care provider when you're there is really important.
Yeah. There are also little apps you can download. I guess maybe all apps are the same size. I don't know why I called it little.
I'm right? with you.
Yeah, okay. There are apps you can download where you can plug in the name of the medication on your bottle, and it can tell you all the information about it. So if you're confused about what type of medication this is, what's the difference between a benzodiazepine and an opioid and these kinds of medicines that have addiction potential, you can quickly. So nowadays, we shouldn't have too much excuse to not know what we're taking, I think.
I have a funny story with that. So when you get your prescriptions, they have the little prescription, the paper that they put in there. I never read them. I toss them out. My wife, she'll go through and she'll read the 3 or 4 pages that's all folded up in there. So she knows exactly how, you know, the side effects, the what to watch for if things are going wrong, and when to call your doctor. So that's important too. There is that paper there. An app is much easier, right?
So just, well, we call that Wifeopedia.
Wifeopedia.
She gives you, she tells you what you need to know.
I got an ex-Wifeopedia.
I do too.
You were talking about that, and that brought up, I don't know how many times, you know, I had a hip replacement. I've had just a litany of surgeries. But every time I'd go to the pharmacist and fill up a prescription, the pharmacist would go, "Here's your prescription. Do you have any questions?" And I can tell you right now, I don't think I ever asked them one. But that seems like that would also be a good resource to where you're not in a doctor's office and go, so, and maybe pick their ear, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's two kind of those point of contacts at the doctor's office. You could ask some questions at that pharmacy. The pharmacists are obviously very smart. They know kind of the contraindications, if that's the right word, hopefully, with the different medications. So if you're taking 2 or 3 different things, great time to ask the pharmacist, you know, is this going to affect this medication in particular or my other medications? And they know all the ins and outs of opioids and the risk of addiction as well.
Now, when you think of useonlyasdirected.org, they've got the opt-out, speak-out, and throw-out. So it seems like we've talked about the speak-out. We've also touched on a little bit of the opt-out by talking to your doctor, asking if there's anything else that could be used to help with this pain. But I want to spend a little time on throw-out because that seems to be a big resource for people, addicts, getting their fix. And so what do we talk to people about throwing out? What are some of the rules and guidelines and general knowledge for that?
Yeah, so when you're done with your prescription, if you took all of your pills, obviously you throw the bottle out, right? You throw it in the garbage, you're done with it. Oftentimes, particularly with opioids, you get the 14 days for your wisdom teeth and you don't use it all. Throwing it out, finding a responsible and environmentally friendly way to throw it out in the garbage. There's take-back boxes across the state in law enforcement buildings or city public locations, and often a lot of pharmacies now have these drop boxes where you can just go take your old medications. They don't have to be opioids. They can just be any medication. You can take them back there. That is a great option because you don't want those hanging out in a medicine cabinet. You don't know who might break into your home, come into your home. You don't know what family members might be struggling with something that might try and raid your medicine cabinet. And so reducing that supply is going to reduce the likelihood of somebody relapsing or to someone becoming addicted to a medication. And so getting rid of those quickly is an option. And so those drop boxes provide that. I can go there whenever I want. The other last option would be take back events. Our communities typically hold take back events twice a year through the DEA. And oftentimes local coalitions will hold their own take back events. So finding those, obviously those you tend to hang on to the pills a little bit longer. So that might be a last resort. But getting rid of those medications as soon as you're done with them is important.
Something that just popped into my head is that, I'm at that age now where my parents are getting a little bit older. And, to make sure you go over there and check their cabinets as well. Because they came from a generation where we didn't throw anything away because you never know where you're going to need it again. And so you go in there, and I know when my grandmother passed away, we opened up her medicine cabinet, and it looked like a pharmacy. I mean, there were so many pill bottles in there. And so make sure you do that too, right?
Yeah. It goes back to know your script, right? So know what to say to your older parents as well. They tend to get more medications than the younger generation just because they're older and have different ailments. And so having that conversation with them and then periodically checking to make sure they don't have a lot of unused medication just sitting around is really, really important.
Now, I'm from the Biggity Biggity O, that's Ogden to you and me. But for people listening to this podcast, will you tell everybody what Weber Human Services offers up there?
Yeah, so Weber Human Services, obviously they provide the treatment aspect. So if somebody's dealing with addiction, they have the counselors, the therapy there to help someone deal with that. Also, the end that I work on is the prevention side. And so they do a lot of prevention. Prevention deals with risk and protective factors. And so they have a lot of local coalitions, typically centered around their high school. So there's like a Fremont High School Cone Coalition or Ogden High, or a Bonneville High School Cone Coalition. And they're dealing with the particular risk factors in those particular communities, doing strategies and events to help avoid future problems with our youth, with addiction and those type of things. Use Only is Directed has been key up there. Bonneville High School Cone has just recently did some really cool installs at their park. One of them being a picnic table that was, you just couldn't sit at it or eat at it. And it was, this is an option, but you probably have better options. Same thing with kind of that, speak to your doctor. You have, this is an option, your opioid's an option, but maybe talk to him and see if there's a better option for you. So spreading that message and that word out there in the communities there in Ogden.
How prevalent is the abuse with the younger kids?
So with opioids in particular, we don't see a ton of misuse with youth. So youth between in that high school age range aren't misusing opioids very often. There is that breakdown. So we do prevention early, right? The earlier you talk to somebody, the less likely they are to engage. Mm-hmm. There does seem to be a little bit of a breakdown there between high school and that young adult age. 25 or so is when we really start seeing opioid misuse pick up. And then there is some risk with our youth with stimulants. And so more and more youth are starting to use stimulants as a way to either deal with their stress, their anxiety, or to do well with their performance in school. So again, parents, have a good relationship with your children, bond with them, and know your script. Know what to say to them, know how to talk to them. Have a conversation early with them about prescriptions and opioids, alcohol, and other drugs as well. And to help them know, when they might be at risk. Again, they might not see a stimulant as risky, particularly if their friend gives it to them and says, hey, this will help you on a test. But if you can have that conversation before they're offered that opportunity, they're going to be knowledgeable and know how to make the right decision.
You know, we've said it on the podcast before. Talk to your kids about drugs and alcohol before somebody else does first.
Yeah, I think that's great advice, essential advice, really. Otherwise, you know, kids believe all sorts of crazy things. And, you know, if
I believe they were barking spiders until I was 15.
They're not?
No, it's just my dad.
Oh, just your dad. Okay. And, well, yeah, anyway, we won't go down that path. But one of the things I found talking with parents a lot is that later teen where you're, you know, age like 16, 17, 18, they're still at home. They may have their own prescription for a stimulant. And a lot of parents are trying to teach their kids independence and responsibility at that age. But one of the scary things, so if a parent's listening and you have a kid that age with a stimulant prescription, I don't recommend you turn that over to them 100% so that they have their bottle in their backpack and they're going around with, you know, 30 pills.
For those who don't know, what would a stimulant be?
Ritalin, Adderall, methylphenidate, these medications that are typically prescribed for attention deficit disorders. And so it's not that you necessarily can't teach the child responsibility, but I recommend instead getting a pill tray with the days of the week and filling it up and keeping it someplace like in the kitchen where a parent can peek and see, A, are they taking it, which is sometimes a problem that they aren't if they're supposed to, but B, that big numbers of pills aren't disappearing. And so I definitely recommend there are other ways to teach your kids responsibility and kind of hang on and keep track of those pills in your own house, see what's happening with them.
We're going to take a break for a minute. We're going to bring in Mary Jo McMillan. She's the executive director at USARA. You've been listening to David Watkins with useonlyasdirected.org. You're listening to Project Recovery. We'll be right back.
2 years ago, Americans watched in horror as a crisis unfolded at the Kabul airport.
She was tear gassed and beaten.
Images of thousands desperate to escape Taliban oppression filled our news feeds. More than 80,000 Afghans made it to America. But the story didn't end there.
It was very cold. There was no power, no heat.
Who would help our newest neighbors? I'm Andrea Smartin. In Stranger Becomes Neighbor, you'll hear the stories of some remarkable refugees who left their homes and their dreams behind only to start over from zero.
Their only possession was 3 blankets.
And you'll meet Americans who stepped up to help them.
You want me to come when you deliver your baby.
What can one person do in the face of an international disaster decades in the making? That's Stranger Becomes Neighbor. Find us at kslpodcast.com. Follow us on Apple Podcasts or anywhere else you listen.
Welcome back to Project Recovery. I'm Casey Scott. That's Dr. Matt. We just heard from David Watkins with useonlyasdirected.org and talking about what the state's doing right now about the opioid epidemic. They've got a new program they're rolling out called Know Your Script.
But I wonder if that has a double meaning.
I think it has multiple meanings.
Yeah, but what do you think? I was noticing there's a double meaning there.
Well, yeah, so know your script, and right. That's the script that the doctor gives you,
yeah,
a prescription.
Right.
Know your script when you're talking with your kids.
Or the doctor.
Or the doctor, yeah. Or your parents. Go in with as much education and knowledge as you can.
Yeah.
So you're not caught off guard.
Right. That's clever.
Yeah.
That's very clever. I like it.
And so that's what we wanted to do is let everybody know a little bit more about what's going on. Because we've talked about on this podcast is what everybody needs in the world of recovery is more education. And we need to lessen the stigma. We need more people in on the conversation so we can get a hold of this and try to figure out ways to make it a little bit better for everybody involved.
I call it the schoolhouse rock principle.
What's that?
Knowledge is power.
Knowledge is power. I thought that was Public Enemy.
I think it is too. But they probably watch School Rock.
But one of the great resources the state has is the Utah Support Advocates for Recovery Awareness, otherwise known as USAR. We got Mary Jo McMillan here. She's the executive director. Hi, Mary Jo.
Hi, Casey. How are you?
I'm wonderful. How are you?
I'm good. I'm really good.
So we've had USARA on the podcast multiple times because you guys are just a wealth of knowledge and you have so many different programs to help out addicts in recovery on every walk and every stage through it. So what do you guys like most about what you offer?
Well, USARA, you know, so that people know, we are called a recovery community organization, and it is run by people in recovery themselves. They're people with a lived experience, so they're individuals who have had a substance use disorder, struggled with addiction, and also we have staff that are family members, people who have had a loved one who have struggled with addiction. So we really come from a place where we've been through the struggle, and we also are living in recovery. We're people who actually know how to change our lives and our behaviors and take care of ourselves and be healthier. So from that experience, that's what I think makes us unique in calling for help, because we come from a place where we don't necessarily tell you what to do. We want to find out what it is you think you need, and how can we help you? That's our first question. How can we help you today?
You know, yesterday I was talking to somebody who reached out to me on Facebook, and they were asking about my recovery. And I had to stop her and say, this is my recovery. This is what works for me. I can tell you what I'm doing, but I cannot tell you if it will work for you. You need to find out what's going to work for you, what is sustainable, and what you're willing to do. And those are the questions that you need to ask. Dr. Matt and myself, we have found out on this podcast, most people think the opposite of addiction is abstinence, but it's not. The opposite of addiction is connection. And you've got a community where so many people can come and find that connection. Not so much as, you know, I mean, for the addicts themselves, but I know we've had people on to talk about your family support system, because parents don't know what to do. Loved ones don't know what to do when they're not addicted, but they are now living in this addicted world, and they've got to figure out how to maneuver it and what their recovery is going to look like.
Right. That's exactly true. You know, I'm a person in long-term recovery myself. And as of yesterday, September 16th, I've been in recovery for 35 years.
Woo!
Right?
Nice.
So, yeah.
Yeah,
so from both drugs and alcohol. And I was 24 years old when I actually went to treatment for an eating disorder. I was still using a lot of substances, drinking to blackout, and nobody ever talked about that problem until I got to an inpatient program where they said they actually had a unit with substance use where they treated it, and they told me that I needed to be on it. And, you know, culturally, I mean, I grew up in, you know, the 70s and the 80s where, you know, we didn't have the abundance of scripts, but we had alcohol, tobacco, and marijuana abundant. And then also pills started to come on the scene. And of course, heroin's always been around. And so I grew up in that environment where it was a party. You know, my parents were drinkers. My dad an alcoholic, but he wasn't a disaster. And my family wasn't a disaster. But a lot of people have been crippled by that. So, you know, we're in this age where we get to talk about it. You know your script, know what to say, know what to ask, you know, and, you know, consequently, because recovery is prevention, as we, you know, we're talking about today, you know, my kids have grown up today with a very healthy knowledge about substances, you know, and they know what the conversation is. And that's really important.
You know, it's something that's kind of a hot topic in the recovery world, because I mean, you want to find out about the recovery world, you're going to ask five different people, you're going to get six different answers,
right?
And everyone's trying to figure out what their recovery looks like to them. But I know there's kind of a big hot topic with harm reduction. And what I like about USARA is that you guys willing, love, and want to talk to everybody in their addiction and see what you can do to make their life better. That's what it seems like USARA's main goal is to make their life better. And that's kind of what you do. Can we talk a little bit about harm reduction?
Absolutely. So, you know, I think, you know, if we look at people who have struggled with substances, whether they're identified as dependent or not, or they're somebody who may not want to stop using substances, they're a person. They're a person who truly wants to feel better, to have their life be better. Nobody wants for their life to spiral out of control and you know, just, like I said, be a disaster. So I think, you know, when we meet at USARA, we meet USARA. I say it both ways sometimes. Old habit. But when we meet with somebody, really it's the individual. We're not really sitting down saying, okay, so what drugs are you using or how much are you drinking? We're not clinicians. We really come from this place of, you know, tell me about you. You know, you're not the, you know, we don't see you as the addict or the alcoholic. And that's language that we change. We're not identifying them by a label. We're not even, you know, addressing their substance use disorder. We're addressing them as a person. So when you talk about harm reduction, really somebody who is maybe still, you know, maybe they're recovering from using an opiate, and for them that is detrimental to go down to relapse with an opiate, but they still might be drinking alcohol. You know, we talk to them about what's that like for them, you know, and have an open conversation. Some people might be safe to drink and others may not. And it's hard to know. But I think as an individual, if you know more about yourself and you have support and you have some of those things that we call recovery capital, you have a safe place to live. How are you doing with providing for yourself and or your family if you have loved ones? What are those kind of stability things that you can put together in your life? And I think with harm reduction, when we have people who've been using opiates for a long time, they need a medication. They need something that stabilizes their brain and their physical condition so that they can function and be healthier, so that they put those kind of, I would say, social determinants of health and foundation for, you know, not having so much stress in their life by having, home, a job, and support is really important. And harm reduction would be a medication, or it might be their continued use, but how can we support you as you can continue to use so that, you know, you don't wind up becoming homeless or something that would actually cause you more harm in physically, too. I think addiction renders people really physically sick, and we want them to not get so sick. We want them to feel as good as they can so that they're mentally and physically better.
What I like about the harm reduction model is it fits into those stages of behavior change that we've talked about. Not everybody's in the action stage yet where they want to are capable of really making permanent changes and becoming completely sober, but they may be in that pre-contemplation or contemplation stages, and there's a lot of help that can be available if we adopt a harm reduction model, as opposed to a person feeling like, well, I can only go in and get some help and get some support if I'm 100%, like my football coach used to say, 110%.
Right.
He wasn't the math teacher. 100% ready to quit everything. And so that sounds like a daunting task to a person that's in that contemplation stage. Mm-hmm. And I think this model, especially connecting with people that are not a clinician who's going to do a diagnostic interview, but they are people who can connect with you and empathize and provide support and conversation in that contemplation stage. And I believe that, from what I'm aware of on the numbers, that helps people transition to an action stage eventually.
You know, when I was alone and isolating in my addiction, sitting on the back deck, drinking beers, I felt I was alone. I felt I was broken. I had a support system around me, but I didn't want to confide in them because I didn't want to let them know that I was broken and there was something wrong with me. The thing I love about what you guys do, Mary Jo, is that you emphasize the importance of a strong support network. And you can help those addicts find that and realize that they are not alone. Because I know in mine, I think there's so many people in their active addiction that feel alone. And that is a scary place to be. And if you don't reach out, nobody can help you. It's not going to magically just appear. And you've got locations where in the state?
So in the state, of course, we have it here in Salt Lake County. We have it in Weber County, so in Ogden. We have a center in St. George, a center in Price, and also we have recovery coaches at Four Corners Behavioral Health in Moab, Utah. So, but now, you know, since COVID has happened, we do also have connection both virtually and through the telephone. And talking to people where they're at, reaching out, they can get a weekly phone call just to check in. That's something that we are really moving more towards being statewide, so that anyone in the state could have access to talking to somebody in recovery, or somebody who they can talk to about those kind of, you know, my ambivalence about changing. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think stages of change are really important to recognize. You know, when you're considering not, you know, continuing to use a substance that might have been, you know, the best way to deal with your stress and self-medication, it's a hard thing to give up. And you might might not be ready. And a lot of people have been coerced. Criminal justice has coerced people to do that. It's suggested by a medical person, or a medical person may not bring it up, but I know, you know, but I'm not ready yet, or I'm just, I don't know if I want to at all. You know, I think having that conversation and not having to be ashamed about talking about it, you know, harm reduction is a really important piece to that, because somebody may do it less or do it safely in such a way that they might be able to function. And if they have a struggle, then they can say, you know, it's not going so well for me. You know, I think I might need more help. And then we can have that conversation.
I think shame is one of the biggest obstacles mm-hmm. for people who are contemplating getting help or mm-hmm. reducing the amount they use or becoming sober. I think shame is a big obstacle, and so that's why people don't bring it up to their doctor sometimes, even their therapist, somebody who they might trust with other things. They might worry about judgment, and so it's great to have these resources. In fact, a lot of people that I've recommended check out your organization are family members, mm-hmm. people, you know, parents who are like, I think my son has a problem. This is what's going on. Who could I talk to find out more about what I can do? And I think that's a huge part of what, it's not just for people who are using, but it's also for that whole family unit. Because if one person's struggling with addiction in the family, right, everybody is being affected by it. And as a parent, you know, you don't want to ever feel powerless over your child's problems. But with something like this, we don't always know where to go.
You know, that I appreciate you saying that, because I think that, you know, family members are thinking, you know, I don't want anybody to know that this is happening to our family. And I think, you know, it's always been, you know, well, those are the bad kids. And if I'm the parent of a bad kid,
I'm
a bad parent. And so, you know, I had great parents. I mean, they had their deficits, but I had really great and loving parents. You know, I was, you know, so it really can happen to anyone. And I think the vulnerability that families feel is how to have that conversation. And I think in Utah, we've done a really good job of really decreasing the stigma, promoting the awareness. We have had a lot of support from the State Division of Substance Abuse and Mental Health, our state legislature, the programs, our hospitals are really doing a great job now of promoting prevention and treatment being available and recovery. And so I think family members should now have, you know, at least some information to know where they can go to start talking about it. But shame still happens. You know, shame is really so internal. And even if I have a conversation with somebody I know in recovery and they have had a return of incidents of use, or they're struggling, sometimes they're ashamed just to come back to talk to me. And people are like, well, you can talk to Mary Jo, but it's their shame that prevents them to do it.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that, you know, they, you know, it's like, well, they're just not willing. It's just that they're so ashamed and disappointed in themselves. That's oftentimes why we're lying about it. You know, I don't want you to think I'm bad, because I don't want to screw up anymore. You know, there's all these feelings that I really want to be better. So the conversations are really important for family members to have. And that's what our CRAFT Family Support Program does. CRAFT is not crafts. It's community reinforcement and family training. And the woman who really has kind of grown it in our state, along with other parents, Darlene Schultz.
We had her on the show.
She had Darlene
on the show. You can go back and listen to her on the podcast.
Wonderful. Well, and her team, and she has a team of 40 volunteers all over the state. And so there's these heroes in local communities really throughout the state. You can find them on our MyUSERA website, but that are educated about how to have the conversation with yourself, with your loved one who is not the substance user, and also with the substance user, about how this is impacting your family. And they're healthy conversations that aren't riddled with ultimatums or maybe some anger, because it's hard not to be angry at addiction. It causes a lot of chaos and hurt. But you can have a healthier conversation about it, so that the shame just doesn't continue and anger isn't the first go-to. And I think it's just something I've been truly passionate that our organization has really done that for family members, because family members don't always have a place they can talk about it. And they also get, you know, they also have their own behavioral health issues, stress, anxiety, depression, because they haven't been talking about it. So it's really important that we help the entire family. So
and, Yeah. And when you think about it, 2020 has been a perfect storm for isolation, right. Anxiety, depression. And right now, people really need to get out and find that community and talk to somebody. So I think that's what you guys do for the state that's so valuable and so important. If people want to find out more information about you guys and find a local chapter or find out where resources might be available in their area, where can they go?
So they go to our website, www.mymyusara.com. We also have a Facebook page. And because this month is National Recovery Month, which is an international observance in every September to educate people about substance use and mental health services and how they can connect to them. Our website, we're actually hosting people sharing their own personal story on our Facebook page and this whole week, well, throughout the whole month. And so it's a good place to go and get some information. And maybe you hear something that you can relate to as an individual struggling, an individual in recovery, and or a family member. And so check it out. We'd love to have you connect and give us a call. You can also call us at 385-210-0320. And you have a person in recovery on the other end who would be happy to talk to you.
Hey, manager, thank you very much. I'm going to have you swing the mic over to David real quick because
thank you.
When we were sitting down and we were doing the pre-meeting for the podcast and we were going over the notes, Dr. Matt, you brought this up to me and you said about the naloxone. Tell me what you found.
Yeah, so we have a note here that says there are places you can go, pharmacies, without a prescription and they can help a person who needs naloxone. Is that true? I didn't know that you could do that.
Yeah, Mary Jo might know more about this as well, too. I believe that, yeah, you can go into any pharmacy and get naloxone without a prescription now in the state of Utah. And then there are agencies across the state that will provide that for free as well.
And the pharmacist could be somebody who helps you understand how to use that appropriately. So you can kind of, if you feel like you're a person in need, you can kind of skip that doctor's appointment, go straight to the pharmacy. Is that right?
Well, you could. It's not always free at the pharmacy. What I can tell you is there are free kits out there, both Utahnaloxone.org, and I think you've had Dr. Jen Plum on, provides free kits. They also, we work with them, and we also have free kits at USARA and all of our locations. And our peer coaches are all equipped how to give you information on how to use it, whether you're a family member or an individual. So please contact us to do that. And also Utah Naloxone. And then the Utah State Health Department also has kits at local health departments that we also, as recovery community organization, distribute as well. You can get it in a nasal form or you can get it in an IMs, an injectable form, just that would go into the muscle. And those are free free resources. So
it's a lifesaver.
It's a lifesaver. It is like having a fire extinguisher because you don't know. It's not also just people with addiction. It might be somebody who unintentionally takes too much, you know. And I think when you start to take a pain medication for a good reason, you may overtake it because you're afraid of the pain. And people can accidentally overdose as well. So I think it's really critical to have that. And also if you have a substance user, they're oftentimes using in secret. You might not know. And if you find them, you want to have a kit in your home if you have any suspicion with a loved one. And so, you know, there's lots of places to have it for free.
I feel like that's very empowering for families, especially if you're a parent and you're worrying about a child or a young adult child. Like you said, we don't always know, but especially if we have an inkling that that could be an issue, it's a wonderful resource to give you a little bit of peace of mind, I think.
And I'm reading down the notes here. But there's also, do you know about 211, Dr. Matt?
Tell us about it, Casey.
211 or visit 211utah.org. It's used to be directed for opioid treatment and recovery resources in their country. So all you have to do is pick up the phone, dial 211. It's a simple way to find the assistance you need for an organization throughout Utah. And so that's a great resource because I remember when I was in my addiction, I didn't know where to turn. It's not something that you ever really plan for. And so where do I go? What are the resources? And if people are listening to this podcast or they've got loved ones, they want to find out what resources are in their community. 211 seems like a great way to get started to point you in the direction to recovery.
I think that that's true. 211, you know, it's something that people might readily think of, like, where would I look? And of course, now, you know, Dr. Matt, you talked about we do have the resources. You can Google things, addiction, recovery, how do I get help? One of the challenges sometimes is, you know, it's a heavy marketplace. And so you'll get a lot of different things that will pop up. And some people, when they're in crisis, what's the right one for me? So I think it's really important that you get some support to start to have that conversation with somebody who can help guide you about, you know, what your insurance, how to kind of access, you know, what's the place that your insurance covers, what you might need, what questions to ask. And there are websites that are on our USERA website that you can start to find out those questions to ask. I think it's important when you're dealing with something as serious as addiction is that it's like you said, when you go into your doctor, you go into a professional, you kind of anticipate that they're going to be the person who has all the answers. Not necessarily. They don't know you yet. And I think if you write down that information and you take it in, then you have a better chance of getting the right fit, the right kind of treatment at the right time and the right place.
Hey, Dr. Matt, we learned a lot on the podcast today, and if it wasn't for the fine folks at useonlyasdirected.org, we wouldn't be able to do this and provide a resource for those in the recovery community looking for help, looking for inspiration, looking for hope. And really, that's what this whole podcast is about.
Oh, yeah. I rely on being able to give people referrals. People ask me for all sorts of referrals all the time. And I've always been really happy to be able to refer people to USARA, especially family members, people who are looking for information. I'm a clinician, and I think hopefully clinicians have some expert experience and information and skills that we need. But connecting with somebody who really has been where you've been.
Walk the walk, talk the talk.
Has a type of power and motivation to it that maybe just the clinician doesn't have, right? And so I'm grateful that we have the opportunity to work with them and use them as a referral source. So I hope that people will also pass on their website and information because it's so valuable.
We want to thank Mary Jo and David. It looks like you got something to say.
One real quick. Yeah, because I would tell you, you know, at USARA, we also we rely on clinicians. You know, I think one of that first conversation is, you know, with a person, you know, who's had that experience. But then we also, you know, how could you have that conversation with a clinician or a doctor and really encourage them? Because there's people who are more experienced than our peers that can help them with much more serious conditions. And so helping them know how to have that conversation with clinicians is really important.
That's why I'm so grateful.
So, yeah, team. We're a good team.
Yeah. That's why we're a necessary team.
That's why I'm grateful Dr. Matt will do it, because I can tell you what an addict's thinking, and Dr. Matt will tell us why we're thinking that. You know what I mean?
He's
got the science, and I can tell you this is why I'm thinking. I don't know what I'm thinking, but it felt right. And he's like, well, actually, it's the neurons and the pathways. All right, got it. You got a big brain. Thanks, Dr. Matt.
Yeah, exactly. It helps you to understand yourself and what has happened with your addiction and why, you know, why you wound up that way. I mean, information is really powerful, and the more I have to know more about my disorder, the better chance I have at getting better.
Once again, you can find out more information. We'll have all this stuff posted on our website, useonlyasdirected.org. They got a three-part solution: speak out, opt out, and throw out. And now they're throwing at you, know your script. We'll love it. So thank you very much. You've been listening to Project Recovery. It is a KSL podcast.
Of this program are for informational purposes only. The program is not intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician, licensed therapist, or other qualified health provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition. Never disregard professional medical advice or delay in seeking it because of something you've heard on this program. KSL does not recommend or endorse any specific tests, physicians, products, procedures, opinions, or other information that may be mentioned on the program. Reliance on any information provided on the program is solely at your own risk.
2 years ago, Americans watched in horror as a crisis unfolded at the Kabul airport.
She was tear-gassed and beaten.
Images of thousands desperate to escape Taliban oppression filled our news feeds. More than 80,000 Afghans made it to America. But the story didn't end there.
It was very cold. There was no power, no heat.
Who would help our newest neighbors? I'm Andrea Smartin. In Stranger Becomes Neighbor, you'll hear the stories of some remarkable refugees who left their homes and their dreams behind, only to start over from zero.
Their only possession was three blankets.
And you'll meet Americans who stepped up to help them.
You want me to come when you deliver your baby.
What can one person do in the face of an international disaster decades in the making? That's Stranger Becomes Neighbor. Find us at kslpodcast.com. Follow us on Apple Podcasts or anywhere else you listen.